From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. When I was a kid, I had a little book that explained how the names of things could be misleading. Like, it would say, a pineapple is neither a pine nor an apple. It's a tropical fruit, blah, blah, blah. And I thought of that book when I heard the band Adult Jazz. I mean, they're just out of college, so I guess they are literally adults, but they sure don't play jazz. The Leeds-based group brings its strangely beautiful brand of art rock to our studio later for a live performance. We'll also have another installment in our occasional series, That Was a Hit, about unexpected chart-topping songs. And speaking of topping the charts, in most of the music world, Moby is known as a best-selling musician, producer, and DJ. He sold over 20 million albums. But here at Soundcheck, he's the guy who once guest-hosted the show and was also the original owner of the guitar that now lives in my office. So, what's he been up to lately? When Moby recorded this song, The Last Day, for his 2013 album Innocence, I don't think too many of us took the title literally. I mean, it's just a song, right? Well, as it turns out, no. The last day really did happen in 2012. We are now living in a post-apocalyptic world, and Moby has the photographic proof. His new exhibit of photographs, also called Innocence, is up and running at the Emanuel Freeman Gallery here in New York through December 30th. And Moby joins us here in the Soundcheck studio. Good to see you again.
Nice to see you, too.
So it's a provocative idea that the apocalypse has, in fact, happened, and we just have kind of failed to notice.
Yeah, it's a tricky thing for me to talk about, or rather it's a tricky thing for me to talk about briefly. Mm. Also, because I find as I get older, I become like Grandpa Simpson, like my stories just get longer and longer. And then suddenly you look around and you realize the people you're talking to have just stopped paying attention a long time ago. But so basically, if you remember a few years ago, there was supposedly the Mayan apocalypse.
Exactly,
December 21st, 2012, the world was going to change. And a lot of my hippie friends woke up on December 22nd very disappointed that the world hadn't, in fact, changed. Uh-huh. And I thought to myself, well, if you think of like steering an ocean liner, you know, you could do like a radical spin on the wheel of an ocean liner and you wouldn't notice a change because it'd be very gradual. Mm-hmm. And I figure like the Earth is a lot bigger than an ocean liner. And I stopped to sort of like gain some objective perspective on the world in which we live. And I started thinking, okay, we have a progressive African-American president. Our next president will most likely be a wonderful progressive woman. The world is generally – a lot of the world is moving in a more rational direction. And then there's a part of the world that's moving in a more sort of like atavistic, fear-based direction. Mm. And so I started thinking maybe the apocalypse is rather like an unfolding
as opposed to
like one big boom event.
Got it. Yeah.
And then the more I thought about this, the more I thought, well, there is quite a lot of evidence to support the idea that there is this very benign apocalypse unfolding and we're a part of it.
So did this come to you at the same time that you were doing the songs for the album Innocence? I mean, the photo exhibit and the album have the same name.
Yeah. I was writing the music for the album, and it's a very collaborative album.
Right.
Which had a sort of like a warmth to it that some of the other music I've made didn't have. Because it wasn't quite as monastic as some of the other records I made.
So it was Skylar Grey singing on
and
The Last Day.
And Wayne Coyne and Cold Specs and a whole bunch of people. But then I started thinking about 9/11. And because I was on Mott Street when September 11th happened. And apart from all the horrifying aspects of 9/11, from a semiotic perspective, one of the most interesting things for me was that after 9/11, people would take pictures of banal things in lower Manhattan, and somehow suddenly they had all this relevance and meaning.
Yeah.
You know, like you take a picture of milk in a deli on September 10th, and it was just a dumb picture of milk. Take that same milk in the same deli below Chambers Street on September 12th, and suddenly people like gave it so much extra meaning. And so that also kind of informed the photo show. So I went around LA and took pictures of things that could be perceived as either just banal or evidence of the apocalypse. And then, to make it more interesting, I invented a cult.
The cult of the innocents, and I will quote you here. They first appeared in the seconds after the apocalypse, when the eschatological dust was still settling. Good use of the word eschatological. The eschaton, death, judgment, heaven, and hell.
Yeah, so eschatology would be the study, basically, of the end of times.
Yeah, the four last things, yeah. Bringing with them, this is the cult, bringing with them their silence and their shame as represented in sacrifice and concealment. And here's where things get creepy, because everyone in this cult is wearing a white robe and a mask of some sort, many of them animal masks.
Yeah. So, and the idea there is they're hiding. You know, they're sort of ashamed at what we as a species have done for the last 2,000 years. But did you ever see the Source Family documentary?
No.
Okay. There was this health food restaurant in L.A. in the 60s called The Source, and it was like one of the first trendy health food restaurants. You know, Goldie Hawn and Jack Nicholson would eat there. And the man who ran it developed sort of messianic ideas, and he reinvented himself as a cult leader. And eventually, of course, he proclaimed himself God and impregnated all his followers, well, the female followers.
Right.
But because it was Southern California in the early 70s, they were really stylish and very well documented. So they wore these beautiful robes, and they're like these 20-year-old gorgeous hippies. And so I thought, like, if there is a Southern Californian post-apocalyptic cult, there's going to be some drama to it because it's California, and that's, you know, people don't, you know, they're actors and they're set designers. So that sort of also informed this cult that I invented.
And that, in turn, informs the whole kind of visual world in which the album Innocence unfolded. The cover art, the videos that went with it, the song A Case for Shame. I mean, you know, is that sort of directly related to the silence and the shame of this cult?
I mean, I guess in this era where people don't really buy records, there has to be a compelling reason to make a record. And when I work on a record, I work under the assumption that very few people are actually going to buy it or listen to it in its entirety. So I have to sort of really enjoy the process of making it and be really happy with sort of like a concept. So for the album and the art show and all the photographs and the videos, I just sort of created a world that I found really interesting, perfectly happy with the idea that very few people would ever pay attention to it. So in creating this world, this record, this art show, this whatever, mainly just it just seemed interesting to me.
We're speaking with Moby. His last album was Innocence, and Innocence is also the name of the photo exhibition running through December 30th at the Emanuel Freeman Gallery on West 27th Street here in New York. This song, A Case for Shame, features vocals by the singer who goes by the name Cold Specs.
A fine line will set you on parts while I'm swallowing down, sing me a song. Shook the breeze, shaking my hand across the fire, a quiet stare, sing me a song.
Shame is from Moby's last record called Innocence. That's Innocence with TS at the end, as opposed to the CE version. Featuring Cold Specs on that song, A Case for Shame. You did the video for this yourself. It's clearly a part of the record, the recording. Is it also a part of the exhibit?
Oh, yeah. It's part of this strange post-apocalyptic cult world that I've kind of invented.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in a way, I guess the concept is you sort of create sort of externally supported ideas and a world around them and then sort of see what flows from that.
Right. You know,
it's almost like, I guess, like a David Lynchian approach to things, like create Twin Peaks, you know, and then see what happens.
Right.
You know, I'm not in any way comparing myself to the genius of David Lynch, but
with
it seems
you've
like
worked.
Yeah, we've worked on a bunch of. He directed a video for me. Mm-hmm. I DJed at his wedding. So it begs the question, like, people always ask me, like, what do you play at David Lynch's wedding? I was like, well, you play Brown Eyed Girl and Beyonce because that's what all the people there want to hear. You know, David Lynch might want to hear, you know, crazy pitch down backwards Tuvan throat singing with tons of reverb and delay, but clearly his aunts and uncles and his cousins don't want to hear that.
So as you look at the exhibit of the photos that document this post-apocalyptic world,
mm-hmm.
A lot of them are, you were saying this before, very quotidian, very kind of banal, day-to-day, you know, a guy in a dog mask, maybe it's a woman in a dog mask, in an aisle of a grocery store.
Yeah.
So what's the message there? What are you saying about those activities and those moments in our lives?
Part of it is, and this is where I have to sort of edit myself a little bit so I don't sound too much like just a pretentious grad student. But a lot of it is just semiotics, you know, and the role of signifiers. Like we look at that particular image, the way it's printed, it's actually printed about 6 feet by 9 feet. So
wow.
It's really sort of like when you look at it, it's kind of huge and immersive. But there's so much in it that's so banal. You know, it's this person standing in the pet food aisle of a supermarket and that's it's quotidian, banal, but then there's this odd, dislocated person in a monkey mask and a sheet just standing still in the middle of this aisle. And what I love is that there's no, like, I, as the artist or photographer, I'm not leading anyone to any sort of, like, narrative conclusions.
Mm.
I'm just creating this odd sort of tableau, and hopefully it's a little discomfiting or disconcerting, and then people bring to it what they will.
Right. And neurologists are telling us these days that the brain will try and, you know, it'll work overtime if it has to make sense of, to provide a story or a link.
Neurologically, we love creating meaning and compartmentalization. And so when you provide two, let's say in this particular case, like a supermarket and this person, this sort of scary looking person in the middle of it, like it's two things that our brain is not accustomed to cohabitating.
Yeah.
You know, so it's sort of almost creates this cognitive dissonance. At least that's the goal. Or someone might look at it and just say, oh, there's a guy in a monkey mask in a supermarket.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not, my intention might fall flat completely. I don't know.
Well, you know, another of the songs from the album, Innocence, the video for Almost Home
mm-hmm.
is a kind of similar thing. It just follows a stuffed animal.
Yeah.
You wrote, you called it, quote, the best video ever made involving a stuffed animal on an airplane for a budget of $10 or less. What did you even spend the 10 bucks on?
The less part. So it's actually, I think the budget, because basically I was flying from New York to LA and before I left my apartment, I found this crummy little stuffed animal that I don't know how I'd ended up with. And I just shot it basically on my camera phone. And so I got to LA and like just pretended that this little stuffed animal was making this transcontinental journey to go see some friends. And that's the entire super simple video. So I guess I did shoot Damien Jurado.
Mm-hmm. Who's the guest vocalist.
Yeah. And we met in the middle of Hollywood. So I guess I did have to drive there. So there's probably like 75 cents in gas to go meet Damien Jurado. So let's say the total budget was about 75 cents.
Okay. But it's a really kind of touching and poignant little video as you follow this stuffed animal from
mm-hmm.
the streets of New York to the beach of L.A.
Yeah.
The song is Almost Home by my guest Moby.
So
song is Almost Home from Moby's last record called Innocence. It's also, Innocence, the name of the photo exhibition running here in New York through December 30th at the Emanuel Freeman Gallery on West 27th Street. And if there is a kind of narrative implied in this post-apocalyptic world, mm-hmm. is there an ending? I mean, is there a homecoming for anybody other than this little stuffed animal?
Well, this is my hope. And it's simply that for the last couple of thousand years, if not longer, we've been sort of ruled by fear. And the fear at one point made sense. To state the obvious, like a couple thousand years ago, we were afraid that like the neighboring tribe was going to kill us in our sleep or some bears were going to eat us mm-hmm. or who knows what. But now we're still afraid, and the only thing we have to be afraid of is each other, which is so irrational. And I really feel like...
Have you met some of those other people out there?
Oh, yeah. No, I'm saying it's a justified fear, but, like, it's elective.
Uh-huh.
You know, like, being afraid of a giant bear, that's not a choice. You know, like, you should be afraid of the giant bear because it probably does want to eat your head. But being afraid of other people, like, other people can choose not... Like, ISIS could choose to stop being terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, it's elective on their part.
Right.
And I feel like collectively as a species, we're hopefully going to wake up and realize that the problems we're dealing with are problems that we've created, and it's easily within our power to just stop being stupid. You know, stop creating problems for ourselves. And so to me, that's this transition is away from, like, irrational, fear-based approach to living to, like, a more sort of reason, empirically supported, less fearful way of approaching life.
So this is the apocalypse, to sort of paraphrase Steve Reich, who wrote a famous book called Music as a Gradual Process.
Mm-hmm.
This is the apocalypse as a gradual process.
Yeah, the gradual unfolding of a hopefully less fearful apocalypse.
Now, while that gradual process is happening, though, you're still doing other things besides photography and
mm-hmm.
the last album. There's something coming out at the end of November.
Oh, so years ago, I put out this album called Hotel. And of all the albums I've made, it's probably the one I'm least interested in. But there was this weird bonus album that came out with it called Hotel Ambient. And it's just super quiet, Brian Eno-inspired ambient music. And no one really ever heard it. Clearly not a commercial smash,
mm-hmm.
considering there are no drums, no vocals, no singles. It's not really songs, just quiet ambient music. And I'm doing an ambient tour, and the whole tour is one show at the Hollywood Forever Cemetery in Los Angeles, which is sort of like the Père Lachaise for rock stars and weird movie stars. But the other show is a fundraiser for the Integratron in Joshua Tree. And so the Integratron is this giant dome in the desert. And an astrophysicist in the 40s, I think, was visited by space aliens, so he claims.
Mm-hmm.
And the space aliens gave him the design to build the most acoustically perfect space. So he single-handedly built this giant white dome in the desert, and they do sound installations there. But it's kind of falling apart. Like, two lovely women from Brooklyn run it now, and they moved to Joshua Tree. And so I'm doing a fundraiser for the Integratron. So that's the entire tour is... a Masonic temple at the Hollywood Forever Cemetery, and the Integratron, which was designed by space aliens.
And does it have great acoustics? Have you been in it?
It has very unique acoustics. It's an entire...
That wasn't what I asked, though, was it?
It's a wooden dome. So, like, basically, if you put a rock band in there, it would not sound great.
Yeah.
But for long, slow, melodic music, it sounds... because it's basically a giant wooden echo chamber.
And you're going to do this live?
The way we collectively understand live electronics, this will be live.
Okay. And then the album will be reissued.
The album will be reissued, and I expect roughly 5 people to potentially buy it.
All right. Sign me
up. Maybe 10, if I'm lucky. I mean, it is Christmas, so I'm like, maybe those 5 people buy 2.
Moby's been with us on Soundcheck. The exhibition of his photographs under the name Innocence runs at the Emanuel Freeman Gallery through December 30th. And Moby, always a pleasure to see you.
Oh, yeah. Well, thanks for having me.
song's called Saints, music from Moby here on Soundcheck. Up next, we talk about Stevie Wonder's first and only number one hit of the 60s, and chances are it's none of the songs you're thinking of. Our series That Was a Hit returns next on Soundcheck.
And now, Soundcheck looks back at the pop charts of yesteryear and asks,
That was a hit?
Everybody was kung fu fighting.
They're coming to take me away, haha.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Joining me for this edition of That Was a Hit, our series about unlikely pop chart successes, is pop chart columnist Chris Melanfi. Chris, what surprising number one hit have you brought our way today?
Hey, John. So today I want to talk about a rock, pop, R&B legend. I want to talk about Stevie Wonder.
Why would it be surprising to have Stevie Wonder have a number one hit?
That's a great question. Let's frame it this way. Stevie Wonder has had number one hits in three decades. He had number one hits in the 80s. He had a lot in the 70s. And he had one, just one, in the 1960s. Do you know what that number one hit was in the 1960s?
Would it be My Cherie Amour?
Good guess, but no.
Uptight?
Great guess. Also not the one.
All right, I give up.
The answer, and it was his earliest top 40 hit, is Fingertips, Part 2, in
what?
1963. Yes.
I've never even heard of that.
Yes, and that's why we're talking about it on That Was a Hit today, because it is even possible for a legend like Stevie Wonder to have a totally improbable number one hit. And not only is it improbable that out of all of Stevie's fantastic 60s hits, you mentioned just a couple, that this is the number one hit, this song almost didn't exist. It's kind of, quite literally, an afterthought. It is the vamp at an end of a live performance. It's not even the core performance itself. And that went to number one.
And was he known as Stevie Wonder back then?
Ah, glad you asked that. No, he was known as Little Stevie Wonder. Often, if you gave the full phrase as per the album title, Little Stevie Wonder, the 12-year-old genius. And that's how he was known in 1963 when Motown broke him.
All right, so Fingertips is the name of this song.
Correct.
And so what are we going to hear first?
What I would recommend we hear first is the original studio track. It was the first cut on Little Stevie's 1962 debut, The Jazz Soul of Little Stevie, and it was all instrumental and only about 3 minutes long.
That is Little Stevie Wonder and the studio version of Fingertips from a 1962 record called The Jazz Soul of Little Stevie.
That's right.
He's 12 years old, Chris.
Yep.
And I don't hear piano. I mean, I don't hear him on, you know, harmonica or piano or singing.
Yep. I'm glad you brought up harmonica because that's like the big thing you don't hear, right? I mean, if we think of Stevie Wonder and we think of the instrument, I mean, he can play multiple instruments, right? But when we think of the instrument he's probably most famous for, it's his phenomenal harmonica playing. And there's no harmonica on that track.
And no singing.
It's an instrumental. Stevie on that track is playing bongos. So quite well, but, you know, certainly not right. What Little Stevie was going to become famous for.
All right. And this is not the hit.
No, it is not.
The weird number one, but this is the setup.
Correct.
For what. Okay, so explain how this happens.
So a couple albums later, they captured Stevie in a live performance at Chicago's Regal Theater. It was recorded in, I believe, 1962, but then the album was released in 1963. That album was called Little Stevie Wonder, the 12-Year-Old Genius, and it's a live album. And they recorded Fingertips. In fact, Fingertips was the last track of the set. And one of the things that's amazing about this performance is it was part of a Motown revue. So Little Stevie Wonder was not the only act on the bill. He was one of several. And that's an important detail, by the way, which we'll get to in a sec. In any case, live, this version of Fingertips went on for about 7 minutes. So it's quite long. It's pretty radically transformed. I don't know if you guys have the full version, but how it starts out is in and of itself interesting. Because you hear just a little bit of Stevie play bongo, but then very quickly he switches to the instrument for which he is now famous, the harmonica.
Jump up and down, do anything that you want to do. Yeah. Yeah.
And then when they get to part two, so they had to release this thing as an A and a B side.
Correct. Yeah, just like when we talked about Shout by the Isley Brothers, right. And the way that was released on a 45, and you know, 45s only had 3 to 4 minute sides. They divided this on a 45 into a part one and a part two.
And so it's part two, the B side, that becomes the number one hit.
Exactly, which is truly improbable.
All right, and this is how that B side, the live version of Fingertips by Little Stevie Wonder, begins.
Everybody say yeah! Say yeah! Say yeah!
Little Stevie Wonder. So there we hear the harmonica, and we hear Stevie singing, sort of, the leading the crowd, you know, clap your hands, etc.
Yep.
Still an improbable number one hit. So this is, we're talking about the year 1963?
That's right.
Okay. Chris Malanfi, pop chart columnist and regular contributor to Pitchfork and Soundcheck, is joining us to look back at Stevie Wonder's unlikely first and only number one hit of the 1960s, which in itself is a big surprise. But then, as this live thing goes on, you went to great lengths to point out that he was not the only person on the bill. Why?
Because there's a moment in the full-length version of the track, it's about, I don't know, 5 minutes and change. In the single-length version, B-side, it's maybe two and change in, where it sounds like Stevie's done. He starts really vamping. I mean, he's already vamping with, you know, the clap your hands just a little bit louder. You know, he's totally riffing. But then he, on the harmonica, the band slows down. He plays Mary Had a Little Lamb on the harmonica. It sounds like he's kind of winding the crowd down. And then just as it sounds like it's going to end, he starts blowing on the harmonica again. And the crowd gets completely riled up and the band comes back. In fact, the band that was setting up for the next set was already coming on stage. I had to check two different sources. One source says it's the band for the Marvelettes. The other source says it's Mary Wells. But either way,
it's another band.
It's another band setting up for the next act on the Motown Revue. And a bassist, reportedly it's Joe Swift. He sees that the band is kicking back in and he yells out, this is the most famous flub in the record, and it was left in. It's completely audible. He says, what key? What key? He's like, I'll play with you guys, but you gotta tell me what key this is if this thing's gonna go on for another 2 minutes, which it does.
That's a really wonderful moment that, you know, really makes this number one hit, Chris, completely unusual.
Very unusual.
The fact that there's this sort of this other bassist kind of wanders out and starts playing with the band.
Exactly.
So the album is Little Stevie Wonder, the 12-year-old genius.
Mm-hmm.
The album has this unexpected number one hit.
Yep.
How's the album do?
The album is also a number one hit. Stevie Wonder actually had both the number one single and the number one album in the country on the respective Billboard charts, the Hot 100 and the album chart, in the late summer of 1963, which is, again, incredible. By the way, that album, Little Stevie Wonder, the 12-year-old genius, remains the number one album by the youngest artist ever. He was, again, only 12 years old at the time, and he was only the second teen ever to have a number one album after Ricky Nelson, who was several years older than that.
Wow. So this, you know, when you're a 12-year-old with a number one hit, that has novelty written all over it.
It really does. And that's the most interesting thing to me as a chart analyst about this number one hit. It sort of explains Stevie Wonder's career trajectory, and it gives you a little more context. One of the most well-known facts about Stevie Wonder and the thing that everybody thinks about when they think about the arc of his career is how he began to exert independence at the turn of the 70s from the Motown machine. You begin to realize just how powerful this move was by Stevie, because basically it wasn't like he'd had a bad 60s. As you and I were discussing before, he had phenomenal top 10 hits like I Was Made to Love Her and Uptight and Shoo-Bee-Doo-Bah-Day and all phenomenal songs. But he really was trying to distance himself from an early moment when he was kind of like a novelty act. You know, I mean, he was part of the Chitlin circuit, certainly as a, you know, vision-impaired African-American performer. Ray Charles had already blazed a trail for him.
Right.
But he's still perceived as kind of like, you know, this novelty act. And it took him some years to really pull away from that and become his own man.
And his next number one hit would not be until?
1973 with Superstition. So it took him the better part of a decade to go back to number one.
But that career of Little Stevie Wonder, beginning with an unexpected hit in 1963 called Fingertips Part 2. Chris Melanfi, as always, a pleasure.
Thank you, John.
Very superstitious, writings on the wall. Very superstitious, letters about to fall.
Stay with us to hear a live performance from the English art pop band called Adult Jazz. That's right after the break here on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. I have to admit, when I saw the words adult jazz up on the soundcheck board, I was skeptical. I mean, those two words to me suggest like Muzak-y melodies played on keytars and flutes. Fortunately, it turned out that adult jazz is a band, and a really interesting one. Not just different from Muzak, but different from just about anything. Long-form art pop that soars in any number of different directions. And they are here with us in the Soundcheck studio today to play some songs from their debut album, Gist Is. This first one is called Springfall. Here, live on Soundcheck, is Adult Jazz.
The foolish babe, a foolish babe. Did I foolish babe. My sugar veins, my sugar veins. Did my sugar veins. The foolish babe, the foolish babe. Did foolish babe. My sugar veins. My sugar veins, my sugar veins. Right on. I'm down. My vein.
Is called Adult Jazz out of Leeds, England, and they're playing for us live here in our New York studio on Soundcheck today. That song is called Springful. The band's debut album called Gist is out now, and the members of the band include Harry Burgess on vocals and electronics, Stephen Wells playing guitar, Tim Slater behind our drum kit, and Tom Howe playing bass and keyboards. Harry, to you and the rest of the band, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you very much for having us.
So Springful is kind of typical for you guys, it seems, in that song form, you know, the chorus, verse, bridge, chorus, verse, is a little more elastic when you guys get hold of it.
I think a lot of the tracks, especially that one, reflect the time we took to do them. I think they had about, each of them had about, you know, 20, 25 incarnations and different kind of arrangements of parts and structure as well. So I think, for better or for worse, it kind of reflects that kind of slightly ambiguous path that the songs kind of had initially.
Right. So,
yeah, Springful does reflect that, though, definitely.
And you've heard the Shabazz Palace remix
of
this song, which is, like, completely different yet again.
Yeah.
Are you fans of theirs?
Big fans of theirs, yeah. Really like Black Up, their first record, and have been getting into this summer, the new one, really enjoying that. And so, we're really honoured to have them want to have a go at fiddling with one of our songs.
And what is that like? I mean, you know, this is your first record, and here you're already being remixed, and it's a pretty radical remix, too.
Yeah, it is certainly radical, and it's so strange to hear stuff. It's to have someone else remove context for you and rearrange things and hear how it just reminds you how differently people hear everything ever.
Yeah. It's funny you use the word ambiguous. It's like if you sort of half know a language and you find yourself in a place like if I was in France and I had to do an interview with someone with a translator, and what I found was after a while I sort of got the gist of what my interviewee was saying even before I heard the translator. I had the same experience with the words that you sing on this record, even though they're in English, ostensibly
English. Yeah, I think we were really keen to. Well, certainly, there are lots of times when we're writing the songs where you're moved to sing some kind of vocal exclamation that's kind of preformed, not quite language, and then you've got this brutal job of trying to transcribe meaningful words on top of that. I think there was times where we kind of were happy to give up that job and let kind of the more preformed singing. For example, there's a bit in a track where I had to sing. It was like kind of an Icelandic sounding S, like one of the hard S's on what's the word in pigeon skulls at the end. I can't remember anyway. But I had to do like a really hard.
You're getting blank stares from the rest of the band too.
What's the last line? It's on the phrase kick ass, which is something I wouldn't usually say anyway. But the S was hard and it sounded ridiculous, sounded like I was putting on an accent, but every time we tried it with a soft S, it didn't work. And so we're kind of quite happy to let the voice like be quite subordinate to the expression.
Well, it's interesting because it's almost like voice as instrument rather than as, you know, the simple carrier of a message encoded into text.
Yeah. So. I think the one thing I've struggled with is that a lot of people have seen that and thought that as a kind of like a precursor to it being kind of nonsense and not necessarily important what the content of the words are. But I kind of, that's why I absolutely had to have the lyric insert, because the words are very important and really thought about, but I just didn't want necessarily to have to say them in an ugly, audible way all the time.
Yeah. The band is Adult Jazz, and they're here in our New York studio. You want to do another song?
Yeah, we'd love to. We'll do I'm Gone.
I'm Gone is the name of it. The album is out now. It's the debut from Adult Jazz. The album's called Gist Is. And here is another live performance in our soundcheck studio.
That's the way to sugar a life. Oh. such death. You up above some lunch death. You up above some lunch death. Ooh, can I spell life for Kido?
Once again, the English band Adult Jazz, live on Soundcheck with a song called Am Gone. You'll find a studio version of that on their album Gist Is, their debut record, which is out now. Once again, Harry Burgess singing, this time playing guitar. Stephen Wells moved from guitar to bass, and Tim Slater still behind the drums, Tom Howe handling electronics. And Harry singing almost doesn't seem to do justice to what you do with your voice. You've got like two distinct registers.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that a countertenor, the falsetto voice?
I'm afraid I'm not the person to ask. I've got much of the lingo, I'm afraid, with regards to it. But yeah, I don't know. I like singing in you know, quite a feminine high voice a lot of the time, and then you can kind of, you know, counter that with, I don't know if that's countertenor, but counter that with a kind of like a slightly more dramatic kind of preachery vibe.
Yeah.
So I guess those are the two poles of it. But I mean, to be a better singer, you want to have more in the middle as well. So I'm working on that as well, the kind of slidey range.
The band Adult Jazz, the debut album's called Gist Is. You won't hear anything like it this year, and they've been playing some of it for us here in the Soundcheck studio. Harry, this has been a lot of fun. I really enjoyed hearing the record.
Thank you so much for
and hearing
us.
It today. You have a song to play us out with?
Yeah, we're going to play Duntung.
A reference to the poet, John
Donne. To John Donne, yeah, certainly.
Getting into that kind of mystical
yeah.
realm.
I don't know, really. It was more of a nod just because of the style. It's kind of like, there's a big turn at the end, which he always does, and it's kind of about whether you're going to go to heaven or not, and he didn't know. He was well worried about that.
So. All right, big ideas
in
a little poem or in a 5-minute song, as the case may be. Let's hear another live performance from the band Adult Jazz on Soundcheck.
And it's a cruel till I feel, ooh, I buckle up, whittle down all the
that feel. But there is just one thing to ask, to call a believer. Now you lose from me. Now you lose from me, yeah.
That song's called Done Tongue from the Leeds-based band called Adult Jazz. They've been playing for us live here in the Soundcheck studio. As always, you can hear the music and the conversation anytime you like on our website or subscribe to our free podcast on iTunes. Tomorrow on the show, it's a conversation with the original funk pioneer, George Clinton. He'll join us with a look at his decades-long career from the first landing of the mothership to his latter-day resurgence. And live music from Twin Peaks, and this time we're talking about the band. They've gotten a bit of a PR bonus lately from the announcement that Twin Peaks, the TV series, will return in 2016. We'll do our part to get the word out about the band's off-kilter brand of garage rock when they play in our studio tomorrow. Also, we want to remind you that this Thursday, October 30th, you can watch the band Primus performing a special pre-Halloween show live in the green space. Les Claypool and the rest of the band will be performing songs from their new album, Primus and the Chocolate Factory, and judging a Willy Wonka-themed costume contest as well. It all starts at 1 p.m. Just go to soundcheck.org on Thursday to watch live. That does it for the show today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.